Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call Senate Finance Committee to order. Time's 4 minutes after 9 a.m., February 22nd, 2012. With me today is Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Thomas, Senator Egan. And today we've got a financial condition and update from the PERS and TERS retirement system around the state. And we have removed from the agenda today Senate Bill 187, Pension Reserve Fund, and we may continue to work on that in the future. The principal objective today of today's meeting is to invite the Department of Administration to present an update on the financial status of the state's PERS and TERS system, and I've asked the department to address the following issues, amongst other things that they want to address. But the committee would like to look at the asset size, management and fiduciary oversight, the investment policy, asset allocation, and the potential investment performance. And we've also had a presentation yesterday from the permanent fund and the consultant to the permanent fund, Cowan, over the expectations of future market performance. So we'll be having some of that dialogue today also. These meetings basically are for information to the public and the committee, and we won't be taking public testimony today. This is pretty much our annual update. We do this every year to keep an eye on this ever-growing challenge. It seems that we seem to hope with some enthusiasm that the bottomless pit will find a bottom sometime, but we're still looking for that. With that, Mr. Barnhill, can you come forward, please, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Administration. And Angela Rodell, another deputy from the Department of Revenue.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Administration, joined today by Angela Rodell, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Administration. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the opportunity to present again on the status of the Public Employees Retirement System, PERS, and the Teachers Retirement System, TERS. What we'd like to do today is just give you a snapshot of what the vital statistics of these systems look like at this point in time. And this is essentially a reprise of what Mr. Bader and I did almost exactly a year ago. Okay. Down. So the membership, these statistics are taken from the 2011 Comprehensive Annual Financial Report for PERS, the Public Employee Retirement System. In the, we have 160 member employers. That's often easy to forget when we talk about PERS. We often talk about the state of Alaska as the only employer, but in fact there are 160 separate employers, the state of Alaska being the biggest of them. The remaining 159 are municipalities, school districts, and other organizations. These numbers are a little bit dated because of the way we do our reporting. The 2011 CAFR brings into it numbers from the 2010 actuarial evaluation. So while it reports about 26,000 retirees, right now we're just over 30,000 retirees in the PERS system. It reports about 26,400 active members, but right now we're closer to 35,000 active members in the system. That's spread between three defined benefit tiers, tiers 1, 2, and 3. We also have, beginning July 1, 2006, all new employees in the 160 member employers are in the defined contribution tier. And this number actually is pretty active, pretty accurate. We have just over 11,000 actives in the defined contribution system. Total of about 47,000 actives, 75% of which are in the defined benefit system, 25% of which are in the defined contribution system. Turning over to the teacher's retirement system, here we have 58 member employer school districts. It's worth noting that many of these school districts are also members of the public employees retirement system. the CAFR, the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, reports about 10,600 retirees. Today, we're closer to 11,800. And we're closer to about 10,000 actives. Again, one defined contribution tier, starting all employees starting July 1st, 2006, are in that tier, and that number is pretty accurate, just over 2,700 actives. The split between DB and DC, defined benefit, defined contribution, is about 79% of actives are in the defined benefit plans, 21% in the defined contribution. The structure of our retirement system is somewhat different than you see in different states, in that responsibility for various aspects of the system are divided between three different organizations. In other states, particularly California, the leading example of which is CalPERS, the benefits, the investments, and the management of staff are all consolidated into one organization. In the state of Alaska, we've segregated that between the Department of Revenue, which handles the investments, the Alaska Retirement Management Board, which is the fiduciary of the trusts, the assets under management, and the Department of Administration, which is responsible for administering the plan of benefits, making sure the benefit payments go out, paying the medical bills, and contracting with the actuary. This is the page where we'll probably spend a good deal of our time this session focusing on. This is where we derive the unfunded liability. So the unfunded liability is a very simple calculation. Well, I shouldn't say anything's very simple when you talk about actuaries. But I've tried to boil it down into as simple terms as possible. The actuary computes the value of the assets. The actuary computes the value of the accrued liabilities, which is a form of a discounted net present value of all the liabilities the systems will have to pay between now and when the last defined benefit member dies. Takes the difference of those, and that's the unfunded liability. So for
Mr. Barno, on this, can you define actuarial value for the folks at home with the smoothing issue, and then give us an estimate of the market value on 6/30/11?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. The actuarial value of assets, the actuaries use a variety of techniques to smooth short-term volatility in investment markets. So when there's a gain at the end of the year, they divide that gain by five, and they take in one-fifth of it, and so they smooth that gain over 5 years. The same for losses. They smooth the losses over 5 years. What's very interesting about June 30th, 2011 is that, for whatever reason, the actuarial value of assets and the fair value or market value of assets is almost the same. The curves have converged. So when we compute the unfunded liability based on actuarial value of assets and when we compute the unfunded liability based on fair value or market value of assets, it's essentially the same. So for PERS, yes, sir.
Just hold it there for a minute. Could I get the market value? Do you have that, or can you want to get back to the?
I can. Actually, as of June 30th, 2011, the market value of assets was about $11.3 billion. So a little bit, well, again, it's less than. I'm going to say it's a little bit less than, but it is less than. It's closer to the actuarial value of assets than it has been in quite a while. Now, that number has continued to go down, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Rodell will cover that. She's got numbers as of, I believe, December 31st, 2011. And the numbers have gone down because the third quarter of calendar year 2011 was a loss quarter for the plans. As of June 30th, 2011, the unfunded liability based on an actuarial basis is $6.9 billion. On a market value basis, a little bit more. For TERS, assets, actuarial value of assets, $4.9 billion. Again, the market value of assets, somewhat less than that as of June 30th. Accrued liabilities of $9.1 billion. You take the difference of those, produces an unfunded liability of $4.2 billion. I didn't speak to the funding ratio. So the funding ratio is you simply take the assets in the numerator, divide by liabilities in the denominator, and that produces the ratio. 63% funding ratio for PERS, 54% funding ratio for TERS. We use these funding ratios to just gauge the overall financial health of the system, whether they have sufficient assets on hand to meet the liabilities that will come due over the next 60 years. Actuaries will tell you they like to see 80% funding ratio or better for a healthy plan. We're not close to 80%, so the actuaries will tell you that on a relative basis, we need more funding. Yesterday, Mr. Chair, Callan presented some forecasts, some short-term forecasts and long-term forecasts about expected investment returns. It was the same presentation they made to the ARM board last week. In both instances, there was discussion about Callan's 5 to 10 year forecast that 8% return, which is the expected earnings return assumption that the ARM board has adopted, Alaska Retirement Management Board, is going to be difficult to impossible to meet, and 7% will be a challenge. We had Buck, that's the actuary for the systems, run the numbers last night as to what will happen to the unfunded liability if we get a 7% return over the next 10 years. Now, understanding that because we are still smoothing in gains and losses over time, as of right now, Buck projects that the unfunded liability will continue to go up for the next couple of years as we smooth in the losses from FY09. But right now, all things being equal under an 8% return scenario, by FY21, Buck anticipates that the unfunded liability measured on an actuarial value basis will be about $10.5 billion, assuming an 8% return. With a 7% return by FY21, Buck projects that the unfunded liability will be closer to $12 billion. That differential is about $1.5 billion. So that's the impact of returning 1% less than the return assumption for the next through FY21. Now, remember, Callan projected that 8% returns over the next 30 years, they believe, are still achievable. So in the long term, those numbers will come back.
And we've heard that story for many, many years.
That's, Mr. Chair, why I say all things being equal.
Right.
So, Mr. Chairman, so with that, these numbers are staggering, but even with the 8% and the 7% returns, these numbers shouldn't frighten retirees at this point?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman,
I
won't disagree with your characterization. Here's the good news. The good news in the state of Alaska is that this legislature and past legislatures have been committed to providing responsible support to the systems. And by responsible support, I mean the actuaries calculate every year what they call the actuarially required contribution. I like to call it the mortgage payment. If you make that actuarially required contribution every year for the term of that mortgage, which the ARM board has adopted a 25-year amortization term, you will pay off that unfunded liability. The legislature has done that every year since 2000, whenever the ARM board was enacted, 2006. And that's very promising, and that's why retirees should not be afraid, because we are making that mortgage payment. Not all legislatures around the country are doing that. Some legislatures simply don't make the actuarially required contribution. The funded ratio continues to decline over time to the point where the fiscal status of the system is threatened.
And if I could add, Mr. Bruno, we've got roughly $16.7 billion in assets as of this June 30th, 11, and that doesn't include the liquid savings the state has, and also the permanent fund, which constitutionally backs up the liability. So we'd have to walk through the 15-plus billion in savings, the $40 billion in the permanent fund before we became insolvent and couldn't meet our obligations.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. The state of Alaska is blessed with assets. And so the conversation continues to be around this table. How do we responsibly continue to address these issues while still maintaining our commitments to other things in the state budget, such as education, public safety, infrastructure, government services? This somewhat dense set of numbers is the change in retiree premium in the PERS and TERS health care plan from 1978 through 2012. And what it shows is really the extraordinary story of health care cost growth in the state of Alaska, which is, quite frankly, the same as what's been experienced in the rest of the country. Premiums starting in 1978 at $57. This year now $1,200, reflecting on an average basis compound growth of 9% every year for that time period. This is an issue that the Department of Administration is trying to take head on. We need to do something about these numbers. This kind of health care cost growth is not sustainable. And there are two efforts that we're taking, looking at the two sides of the healthcare equation, the supply side and the demand side. The supply side is the patient side. And we are going to enhance our efforts with respect to patient wellness programs within our active plan. And that's going to start in this next fiscal year. And we hope to get some success there. If we do have some success, we'd like to roll out those initiatives to other parts of our population, ultimately covering the entire population that rolls into the retiree plans. Many employers around the country are doing this anecdotally. They have reported some success in bending down the cost curve from 9% growth to something less than that. On the other side of the equation, the physician side, we need to be in conversations with our physician community about the unsustainable nature of cost growth increase and how we can partner with them to make healthcare cost growth sustainable for the state of Alaska as their principal customer, but not bankrupt the healthcare industry. Both sides are important. One important thing to note on this chart is the last year. You can see the premium went from $1,176 to $1,200. It was just a 2% increase. We're very pleased with that. That's not something that our office can take any responsibility for. That is a product of efforts underway. And also, in fairness, it's a product of historical health care volatility. You can see as you go through the annual percentage changes, there are years of flat growth followed by years of double-digit growth. The challenge we have before us is to convert this flat growth to sustainable, modest growth, as opposed to flat growth followed by double-digit growth. This chart shows the funded status over time in the public employee system. We've spent time around this table discussing particularly the years 2001 to 2002, where the system went from an apparent full-funded status down to less than 80% in one fell swoop. That change prompted the litigation against our former actuary. We've remained down in that range below 80% for some time. The reason why we have that is the product of a number of reasons, and these reasons these risks are endemic to any defined benefit system, and they are as follows. Investment loss. We've had multiple occasions of investment loss over this time period, 2001 to 2012. I believe we've had four loss years in that time period. Over that time, the ARM Board's investment return assumption was 8.25%. Just recently, they reduced it to 8%. That means that every year, the system expects to earn at least 8%. If you have a loss year, you've not only not earned the 8%, you've lost an additional amount, and so you've fallen even farther behind. The systems struggle with that, will continue to struggle with that, as per Callan's presentation yesterday. Another reason why we've continued to struggle with funded ratio is assumptions don't bear out as we expect them to. The actuary projects that health care costs will decrease over time, but they don't decrease over time as they had projected. Right now on the actuarial projection curve, they had started up closer to 9%, which is our experience. And we've now graded down to 6% cost growth, and we'll stick around 6% for the next several decades. Our hope is that through efforts that we're undertaking within the Department of Administration, through employees taking better care of themselves, that we'll hit that 6%. But right, we're not there yet, Mr. Chair. And then another reason why we continue to struggle with funded ratio is, while we have struggled with it, is just mistakes get made. And that certainly happened in the 1990s, where the actuaries made mistakes in projecting and computing healthcare calculations. We undercollected for quite a considerable period of time, and we're still now trying to collect the undercollections. The chart for TERS is similar. The funded ratios are slightly worse. When the funded ratios go down, Mr. Chair, the contribution rates go up. And so just a quick few points on how defined benefit systems are funded. The actuary takes the benefits, discounts them to present value, then computes what we need to collect today if all of the actuarial assumptions come true from employees and employers to fund those benefits. Historically, rates for both PERS and TERS have been low, above and below 10%, you know, ranging from 8 to 12%. As we've learned, the truth about health costs in our system and the truth about investment losses, the rates have climbed dramatically from the early 2000s to where they peaked out in 2008 in the teacher system at 50-some percent, in the public employee system at 30-some percent. It was at that point in 2008 that the legislature enacted SB 125 to provide pension relief to municipalities and school districts and cap the school district rate at 12.56%. And capped the municipal rate in the public system, public employee system at 22%. For FY13, we're again back up to that peak in 2008 with the actuarial rate for the teacher system at 54% and an actuarial rate in the public employee system of 35%. This chart shows what's going to happen with our retiree population. It's going to increase. This reflects the now ongoing retirement of the baby boom generation. And so we're just about in 2012, just over 40,000 retirees. Today, it's going to go up to close to 60,000 over the next few years. And then we'll start to head back down. And this is really what it's all about, Mr. Chair. These are the benefits the system is constitutionally required to pay between now and when the last defined benefit member dies, between somewhere 2070 to 2080. The systems will be called upon to pay, starting now, just over $1 billion each year. By the end of the 2020s, the systems will be called upon to pay just over $3 billion. We'll cap out at just over $3.5 billion in the 2040s. We won't dip below $3 billion a year until the late 2040s, and then that will continue down. If you sum that up, that's $141 billion over the next 70 years. It's an extraordinary amount. It's something that I believe the systems are capable of doing when we consider all the resources, contributions from employees, contributions from employers, investment returns, and assistance from the general fund. But it's a big issue, and it's a commitment, and we're committed to making sure that we do it. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn the mic over to Ms. Rodell.
Thank you. For the record, my name.
Hold it there for a minute. Senator Hoffman.
The last statement you said on the $141 billion, you said there was, this can happen. And the last statement was with assistance of the general fund. Do you have a chart of what assistance will be required of the general fund over the time period from 2012 to 2080?
Yes. Oh, well, not that far, but Mr. Chair, I've turned you to page 21 and probably should have just put that up and then address that immediately. So what this chart shows, Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman, is the different ways in which the general fund can be called upon to provide that assistance, which is necessary to make the commitments. It doesn't go through 2070. What it goes through is the time period in which it would take to pay off the entirety of the unfunded liability, assuming an amortization term of 25 years. There are blue bars and red bars. The blue bars are the status quo. There are two ways of amortizing the unfunded liability, two methodologies, if you will. One is called level percentage of pay. One of the actuarial assumptions is that pay will increase by 3 to 4% a year. And if your payment increases at about that amount, that means that your payment on the unfunded liability will increase. So the blue bars increase over time. Another form of paying off the unfunded liability or amortizing the unfunded liability is called level dollar. Level dollar is exactly what a house mortgage is like. When you buy a house for $100,000, you get a note, and your payments are equal every month for the 30-year term of that. That's how level dollar works. The red bars show slightly declining, and that's a product of the actual asset smoothing. But just to boil it down to its simplest form, level percentage of pay is a more backloaded amortization methodology. You're going to pay less now, more later. And level dollar is a more front-loaded amortization methodology. You're going to pay more now, less later. If you look just at the blue bars, which is the status quo, what it calls for is an appropriation from the general fund under SB 125 of $610 million for FY13. And that's what the governor has put in his proposed budget. If we were to adopt the level dollar methodology, that number would go up, depending on the effective date, to approximately $870 million. So that could, if we did it for FY13, it would go up in FY13 from 610 to about 870. If we adopted it for FY14, it would go up then.
Okay, can we jump back then and pick up your presentation so we stay on track? We can go back over this subject again when we get to that chart.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Angela Rodell, the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue, and I'm going to review the current status of the investments within the retirement trust funds. On slide 16, you'll see the current the balances as of December 31st. In the public employees' retirement system, we have approximately $11.1 billion, of which $5.9 billion is in the retirement trust itself and $4.9 billion is in the healthcare trust. The teachers' retirement system has a balance of approximately $4.6 billion as of December 31st, with almost $3 billion in the retirement trust itself. The balance of the $19 billion in the retirement assets under management fall under the judicial retirement system, the National Guard, Naval Militia Retirement System, the Supplemental Annuity Plan, and the Deferred Compensation Plan. On the next slide, is a demonstration of the actual asset allocation as of December 31st versus our target asset allocation. The majority of the assets continue to be in equities with approximately 50.6% in domestic and global equities. This is slightly higher than the target asset allocation. Part of that has to do with manager selections and timing of purchases and settlements. We also have a large portion in fixed income and real assets. On Slide 18, this is a slide you saw yesterday from Callen and Associates, and it just gives you a sense of the historical returns and where 2011 fell versus 2010, 2009, and 2008. And as the Deputy Commissioner stated, these will be smoothed in over the 5 years, both the losses and the and the gains. So on page 19, we present to you the annualized returns through June 30th, 2011. The one-year annualized return for the public employees retirement system was 21.1%. The teachers' retirement system had an annualized return of 21.3%. with an average return of 21.27. Our target for the one-year annualized return came in at 21.62%, so slightly over what PERS and TERS realized. The 10-year annualized return for PERS was 5.43%, and the target was 5.67, again, just slightly under the target return.
I'd like the department to get back, get back to the committee. We can go back 10 years, I guess, and take the market value at that time and the projections that were recommended by Callen as far as the, I think it was, then it was 8.25% going forward, and then roll it forward a year and start with the market value there and the projections, targets, and then roll it forward another year. So we basically have a 10-year rolling number with the projections, because we've had that type of chart here delivered before upon the request of the committee, because we continually get these targeted returns that can never be reached year after year after year. And the discussion yesterday revolved around the potential market returns in and around 7%, which is, I think, what you're going to discuss here in your presentation a little bit, where the return target is 8%, moved down from 8.25%, which the committee had some concerns about for several years in a row. And it was nice to see that the ARM board moved that target down, but it appears that the financial markets have slid even further at least in the projections presented by Callen in coming attractions.
We will get that to you, sir. I mean, actually, that does conclude my presentation for today as to what the returns were, and I'm going to turn it back to the Deputy Commissioner, and we will get that information to you, Senator.
Mr. Chair, on the point you just made, I neglected to also share something else from Buck regarding Callen's 7% projection over the next 10 years. I think this came out a bit at the table yesterday, and that is Callen has an embedded inflation assumption of 2.5%. So they are relatively bullish on inflation staying in check over the next 5 to 10 years. The ARM board has a different inflation assumption embedded in their assumption, and that's 3.12%. So they're not quite as bullish. So when we ran those numbers last night, when Buck ran those numbers, they did not adjust the inflation assumption down to Callen's. They just simply said, if all we get is 7% out of the markets, we're going to be essentially $1.5 billion behind in FY21 versus in an 8% scenario. But the caveat to that is, if inflation is less than 3.12%, if Callen is right and Buck is and the ARM board is incorrect, then the cost of the system will come down by that amount. So the unfunded liability would be adjusted downwards in a 2.5% inflation scenario. I'm somewhat reluctant to suggest that that's what the actuaries should do, is reduce their inflation assumption, because I believe Mr. O'Leary, I think I heard him say it last week, and I think he said it yesterday as well, and that is, they expect inflation to go up at some point. I mean, when we spend this amount of stimulus funds within the country and around the world, logically speaking, I think that was the word they used, inflation is going to go up. So 2.5% seems somewhat more bullish than is perhaps wise in a long-term actual recommendation.
I think one of the ways we can deal with that issue is to go back with the asset allocation and remove the inflation historic inflation numbers and use inflation-adjusted or real numbers and do the projections off of that and take that argument off the table, because we've heard that discussion here, you know, every year about the differences in inflation assumptions. And I understand the difference in why it's there, but what concerns the committee is the perpetual targets that are never that are presented in the, and then contributions are set on them, but they're never attained, and we continue to slip backwards. So I think we need to try to come up with some way of removing that argument off the table. And if you can get back to the committee and real return expectations for this asset allocation historically.
Okay. Mr. Chair, we're back in the presentation to the general fund assistance slide. I'm happy to entertain any more questions. I'll just reiterate the point that the legislature's commitment to either set of bars, the red bars or the blue bars, is of crucial importance to the health of these systems, and really does distinguish the state of Alaska from many other states.
Senator Hoffman.
But the problem that I see, you know, if you look at status quo in the blue bars, that continues to rise, but the problem that we're seeing is that by 2020, you know, and we can't project the future, but the state of Alaska could potentially be in deficit spending at that point without a major change in our revenue stream. We would be seeing a reduction in services at that time, major reductions in services.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, absolutely. And that actually is a great segue, and I can come back to this, there's more questions, to what the ARM board has been working on for the past almost year and a half. This dynamic with the demands on the general fund increasing over time to over $1 billion has been of grave concern at this table, within the Office of Management and Budget, and with the within the executive branch. So the ARM board, actually the Division of Legislative Finance, approached the ARM board in the fall of 2010 and requested that they take some time and effort to look at this issue and see what kind of information and options they could compile for the executive and legislative branches to consider. And so that work started in the fall of 2010, continued through 2011, and by December, the ARM board had compiled 40-some scenarios, different ways of addressing the unfunded liability. And they did that by adjusting five different levers. And this is going to get a little complicated. Feel free to interrupt me at any time. As preface to this, what I will say, and you've probably heard it around the table, that is that the unfunded liability is a soft liability. There are a variety of ways of addressing it. There are a variety of ways of paying it off, ranging from you could pay it off in one fell swoop to you could pay it off over time. What the ARM board did was they looked at five different levers in the amortization calculation. Those levers are the amortization methodology. We've talked about that. There are two principal forms of methodology, level dollar and level percentage of pay. Level dollar is more front-loaded, will put more burdens on the general fund in the near term. Level percentage of pay is more backloaded, will put more pressure on the general fund in the later years. Amortization term, this is just the number of years. Right now the ARM board is amortizing the unfunded liability over 25 years. In addition to that, the ARM board looked at 30 years, 40 years. Cash infusion, that's been a topic of significant discussion within this building. What happens if we put in X amount? $2 billion is a number we've heard quite frequently. ARM board modeled those scenarios. Another lever they looked at is continuation of state assistance or discontinuation of state assistance. What happens if we turn off that SB 125 cash flow? In essence, stop
making the mortgage payment in full every year. And then finally, the Armboard modeled scenarios that called for additional municipal participation, specifically increasing that employer rate cap from 22% to 24%. And then what they had the actuary do is run dozens of scenarios, 40-some scenarios, and then measure the outputs of those scenarios in various ways. The main ways were, how much is it going to cost all of the participants in total to pay off the unfunded liability? When is that going to happen, the date of payoff? How much is the state going to pay? How much are the municipalities going to pay? And what is the near-term burden in percentage terms on the general fund? Now, they measured any number of additional data points in the spreadsheet. I meant to bring it. It's literally this big. And it's got, and I'm happy to share it. In fact, I think it has been shared, so you may have it stuck in a committee packet. So the spreadsheet looks like this. Sorry, Angela. And attached to it are the actuarial runs from FY11 to FY71 of what happens over time with all those data points. Quite frankly, Mr. Chair, this was a really useful exercise. I think everybody looking at the numbers learned something from it, and learned there's a variety of ways, a variety of responsible ways that the status quo can be adjusted. And the ARM board came up with a recommendation in December. It passed a resolution in which it said certain of these scenarios they would recommend the legislature take some more time to consider. Certain of the scenarios the ARM board was uncomfortable with and recommend that there not be further consideration. That does not prevent either the legislature or the executive to continue to consider those. And then some scenarios they simply didn't speak to. And I'm more than happy to discuss that effort or answer any questions on that. That work has culminated in some legislation that's pending, and at a later date, the committee will be taking that up, but we're not taking it up this morning.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at your chart on page 2, and I'm just curious, what in your mind is the relationship between the actuarial assumption and the actual annualized returns and the unfunded liability? Because I look at the percentages, and I realize we had some bad investments and bad advice, and I don't want to go back over.
Excuse me, it's page 11 or 10 or 11 or 10 or 11.
I'm looking at 2 just as a beginning because of the comments you made about the endemic to defined benefit plans, and I think that it's endemic to any pension plan. If you're talking about recessions and things that take place, they all go down. So I was concerned about that. And I'm sure you're familiar with ERISA plans, Taft-Hartley plans, and the situation that many of them are in. But I don't know any, although there may be some, that have gotten themselves in a position of being underfunded to the extreme that we are at this point in time. So I guess my question is, getting back to what I think Senator Stedman was getting at, why would we continue to have an actuarial assumption in the case of Taft-Hartley plans? They're directed by the federal government of what their actuarial assumptions are. They cannot set their own actuarial assumptions. They're told basically they have to adjust them based on the funding levels and returning money to the participants. But I'm curious, looking forward, if we're reducing our actuarial assumption only a quarter of a percent, but our historical return is 3% or so less than our actuarial assumption, I find it hard to believe that we're actually going to accomplish what you're looking at accomplishing going forward.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, first, to the premise of your question that I have any understanding of or expertise in Taft-Hartley plans, I don't. However, I am aware that in ERISA plans that my understanding is, Mr. Chair, that the assumption regarding investment return is more tightly controlled, and what is imposed is something closer to what's called a riskless rate of return, somewhere in the 4 to 5% range. The ARM board could adopt such a riskless rate of return, and in fact, that's been a subject of great debate around the country. There's a professor in Chicago, Joshua Ruau, who is calling upon public pension plans to reduce their rates of return from the 8% range down to the 4 to 5% range. That's certainly something that could be done. Understand what the implication of that would be. When you reduce the rate of return assumption, you necessarily increase the unfunded liability. So if we go down to, say, 4 to 5% from 8%, you essentially double the unfunded liability from $11 to $22 billion. Mm-hmm. By doubling the unfunded liability to $22 billion, you essentially are going to double the contribution rate. So the contribution rate in TERS would be up over 100% of payroll, and in PERS something like 60% of payroll. Now, we've capped rates, right? So that won't put any pressure on municipalities and school districts, because their rates will remain at 22% and 12.5% respectively. But what it will do is it will essentially put a huge demand on the general fund under SB 125. So right now we're at $610 million. That would go up sharply. I don't have the numbers. But to Senator Hoffman's point earlier, to the extent we're concerned about that pressure on the general fund, going to that rate would immediately increase the pressure on the general fund by a large factor.
I understand it would have that effect, but I'm still concerned with taking and going forward, and you don't have to respond, going forward with an unrealistic actuarial assumption based on the history of the actual returns, and I think it would probably be not much different if we went back 20 years.
Maybe what we can do is have them come back, have the department come back to their actuaries with a bugle chart and run the 8%, run a 7, run a 6, run a 5, and run a 4.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. In fact, Buck has just now started running sensitivity analyses in their valuations for that reason. They're not going down to 5, but they do 7 and a 9% assumption. And Senator Thomas, your point is absolutely well taken. I mean, we're just essentially stuck between a rock and a hard place at this point. The time to have adopted that return assumption would have been 25, 30 years ago.
Senator McGuire and then Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, and through the chair. And I just, dovetailing into what Senator Thomas said, I think it is difficult from a political standpoint to double what your anticipated liability would be. But at the same time, I think that's where we got into this mess to begin with. With respect, when I was a freshman in the House, I can remember all of this unfolding. And in part, it was bad advice, and there's a lawsuit surrounding that. But I think also in part, there were some political sensitivities. And I think it is difficult to lay out the real numbers. But as we've seen, we're coming back with 4.3 and 5.4% returns, not 8%, not even close. And so I think it's incumbent on all of us to lay the facts out as they are today. And what's important about that is that it will lead, I hope, to thoughtful solutions. This committee has proposed one. In light of Senator Ellis's legislation as well, putting $2 billion and sort of a forward or front-loading concept that I think is more in line with this level dollar analysis. That's one methodology. Representative Hawker had the idea of pension obligation bonds. There are other solutions, but I think that unless we have the actual facts out and can agree on what they are instead of talking about la-la land and rainbows and unicorns, then we're not going to get to the actual solutions that we need. So I just say that. And then I'd like to hear just briefly, if I could, from Angela. I think it's exciting to have you on the team, having come out of the private sector. And I'd like to hear specifically on page 21 this notion of status quo versus level dollar analysis. And I'd like to know, in your past experience, whether you believe in one methodology versus another. And I ask your concerted opinion, not a political one, because when we're looking at funding levels, it's a difference this year alone of $250 million roughly, and then you can see it run out. But I'd like to hear your opinion.
Sure. Through the chair, Senator McGuire, I think it's important to recognize, first of all, that, as the deputy commissioner said, that we have continued to fund the ARC. And the long-term obligation of the state of Alaska, to the extent that you believe that those liabilities should be paid down while you have resources to pay those liabilities, I would prefer that you would move to a level dollar type of methodology, or that we should move to a level dollar type of methodology, because it will allow those liabilities to be diminished that much quicker, and quite honestly, we will get more credit in the national markets for taking care of those long-term liabilities quicker while we have resources, as opposed to pushing them out and waiting to a time period when it might be even that much harder to pay those liabilities.
Thank you.
Senator Hoffman.
Well, you know, we pay everything above 22% for PERS and 12.57 for TERS, and that is an assistance that we're providing to those programs. Does any other state provide that type of financial assistance for their retirement programs?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I do not know. I am aware of other states that don't make the actuarially required contribution, the mortgage payment. And so I have a sense that this magnitude of general fund assistance is unusual. In fact, what's happening in other states, Mr. Chair, is really quite a disturbing trend, and that is we now have a number of states that have cut benefits to current retirees. Rather than make the payments in order to fully fund the systems, they're balancing the equation the other way, and that is cutting benefits. And that's a disturbing trend that's happening more and more in other states. And there's been litigation in two states. The courts have actually sustained the cut to the benefits. And the nature of the cut is a reduction in the cost of living adjustment. So the two cases that I'm aware of, and I've sent some National Council of State Legislatures materials to the committee aide so they can provide that to you in the fullness of time. But Colorado and Minnesota, in both of those cases, the court sustained.
And why do you think the state of Alaska went to that system to provide this type of assistance?
Oh, why? Through the chair, because the state of Alaska was doing the responsible thing, and under the diminishment clause of the Alaska Constitution, we are arguably required by the Constitution to pay all of these benefits when due. So absolutely it was the responsible thing to do.
Well, I think it was the responsible thing, and I think if we did not take that action, we would have seen some municipalities go bankrupt. Isn't that correct?
Oh, absolutely.
So we've taken that, but does the state of Alaska legally have that responsibility?
Well, you know, through the chair, Senator Hoffman, you're baiting me a bit because you've asked me a legal question, and I'm not supposed to practice law anymore. you know, I'm going to dodge a little bit. There are a variety of ways of doing this. Doing it the way that it was enacted in SB 125 is one responsible way. There are a variety of other responsible ways. There are certainly some municipalities that maybe at their limit in terms of what they can contribute. There are other municipalities, in fairness, that probably can contribute more. So there are just a variety of ways of doing this.
As I recall, there was a considerable amount of discussion as far as the inability of the department to accurately calculate potential liability sharing between the different municipalities in the state, and to avoid lengthy litigation and, quite frankly, as Senator Hoffman said, significant insolvencies with our communities around the state. The state of Alaska stepped in and took responsibility for everything over 22%. And 22 was set as a negotiated amount to make it high enough so that it got the municipalities' attention that we have a problem, but not high enough to push them into insolvency. So I think it's incumbent on the committee to, you know, to uses all the resources that the state has available to it to protect the communities and the participants in the retirement plan, so we don't get ourselves in a position like some of these other states where there is diminishment of benefits to the current and retired employees. Senator Hoffman.
And The final question is, how much is that assistance costing the state of Alaska, and which direction is that going? Is it going to increase substantially?
Right, through the chair. So if you look at the blue bars, that assist. Well, let me just back up. So to date, under SB 125, the state of Alaska has paid approximately $2 billion. So that's 2008 through, actually, it started in 2007 through 2012, split evenly between the public employee system and the teacher system. And then within the state assistance provided to the public employee system, you have to understand that about 60% of payroll is the state of Alaska and the university, 40% is municipalities. So you could say that roughly of that $1 billion, $600 million, the state was going to pay anyways as the employer. So about $400 million was paid on behalf of municipalities, about $1 billion paid on behalf of school districts. Going forward on the blue bars, we're looking at $610 million cresting up to $1 billion in 2025. Again, you can use that same 60-40. Well, first, cut it in half. That's your PERS TERS allocation. And then cut one half into 60-40 to get the 40% that we would be paying on behalf of municipalities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions, Senator Egan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through Mr. Barnhill, I'm just curious. I'd like to know some of the assumptions that you're using in your projections. I mean, like health insurance, are we still assuming that health insurance is going to go up 10% a year, projected through there? Or if I can just get...
If you could maybe briefly comment on that, Mr. Sure. Barnhill, and then get back to the committee on the
Mr.
assumptions
Chair,
put in the model.
Senator Egan, the assumptions used are the assumptions adopted by the ARM board. They revisit these assumptions periodically. By statute, they're required to do an experience study every 4 years, and the actuary and the secondary actuary look at the assumptions and make recommendations to the ARM board. The 10% inflation number keeps getting thrown around. I'm not sure where that's coming from. The way the health cost trend works is it grades down over the course of 100 years. So you start high, around 9%, and you grade down. And as I said earlier, Mr. Chair, we are at about the 6% grade point on the grade. And the assumption going forward will be 6% health cost growth in the actuarial assumptions for the next several decades. Now, the experience of the plans has been 9%, and that was demonstrated on this slide earlier. This shows the premium growth, and that's just actually what has costed. Now, you can see a flattening in the last year. We're down to 2% for that year. If you average the 3 years, those three last years were right around 8-something. That's very promising. But again, you know, we're still in the 8-9% range, and I think it's premature to say that we're flatlined at 6% growth.
And we're kind of running out of time here this morning, but I'd say zero at, you know, 07 and 08 was a little optimistic. Average annual change, zero for those 2 years.
That's just based on the claims experience, and in the early 90s, there was a dynamic going on, and so you look at the minus four and the zero, in the healthcare industry where there was the threat of federally regulated healthcare, the Hillary Clinton plan, and what I have heard suggested is what was going on there, as the health industry unilaterally flatlined their cost growth during that time period. Whether that's in fact true, I don't know. But what we like to look at are sustainable trends. So right now, the trend that we are on continues to be 9%. The actuarial trend suggests we're going to go to 6% over the course of decades, but we're not there yet. We'd like to be.
Okay. We have any other final questions for Mr. Barnhill? Okay. No other. And Rodale, any other questions for her? Okay, well, that will conclude the meeting today. I'd like to thank both of you for coming and presenting this topic. I'm sure we'll be back again next year for updates, and probably back again this year for a little more information as we work forward to trying to get a solution on this $11 billion hole in the ground. The next meeting is tomorrow, 9 a.m. We'll have three bills up: Senate Bill 203, Energy Assistance Programs and Vouchers; Senate Bill 135, Continuance of Criminal Trials and Victims; Senate Bill 140, cathinone bath salts. And that concludes the meeting today. We are adjourned.